Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Baptist deacon, family man, pillar of his Florida community, and serial killer of prostitutes. Chilling true crime from the author of Lobster Boy. By day, Sam Smithers was the deacon of his Baptist church in Plant City, Florida, a respected neighbor to many and a devoted husband and father. But after the sun set, he became something else, a violent attacker and killer of prostitutes. Smithers' twisted double life came to light when a local woman who had hired him to take care of her property found him in her garage cleaning an axe, and then discovered a puddle of blood. Through exclusive interviews with Smithers' wife, who described her spouse as nothing but a doting husband and father, author Fred Rosen learned why this man of God, raised in an intensely religious Tennessee home, was the last person anyone would suspect of committing these savage crimes. Rosen reveals the details behind the deaths of Chrissy Cowan and Denise Roach after Smithers picked them up in Tampa, and the fate of a man who seemed holier than thou, but was actually guilty as sin. The book that we're featuring this evening is Deacon of Death, Sam Smithers, the Serial Killer Next Door, with my special guest, journalist and author, Fred Rosen. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, the incomparable Fred Rosen.
Only Captain America or the Mighty Thor are incomparable. You know, no, I appreciate that, Dan, and I love being with you because you're the best. And
wow,
it's funny,
you, Fred, you're the best.
Well, thank you, but you know, I got to tell you, this book, I spent a lot of time rereading it. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was laughing. I was going, "Oh, that's a good line." You know, because I wrote it a while back. But what's so interesting to me is how this guy's behavior with women is typical of what today we call the Me Too movement, where a guy is harassing women. But here it's only, you know, it's 15, 20 years ago. It wasn't considered a big deal. So, you know, I think we've come a bit
right.
of a ways. You know, which is a good thing, obviously. You know? Anyway. Yeah.
Tell us, Fred, because
yes, sir.
For people that are fans of Lobster Boy, and we've talked about Lobster Boy on the program among about 12 or 15 other books, or at least 12 other books that you have. But one of the more fascinating, obviously, because of Lobster Boy with the actual lobster claws born to. And in this book, Gibsonton, Florida, again,
least
you open in Gibsonton, Florida, and you explain what that is and the relation to Lobster Boy,
sure.
which is Grady Third, you know. So tell us about the Lobster Boy connection and what you were doing in Gibsonton, Florida at that
yes,
time.
Sir. Well, here's what happened. I put all this together. It took about 4 years, okay? In 1994, I was in Florida in Gibsonton, which is the home of the Kearney off-season, and that's where I was investigating the murder of Lobster Boy, who'd been a Kearney freak and was killed in a murder-for-hire scheme by his ex-wife and her son, and I had gotten involved in the case and came up with the evidence that led to the conviction of the killer, two of the killers. Anyway, the point is, that 4 years later, I was talking to a woman named Vilma Bean, who was a public information officer in the St. Police Department, Hillsborough County. You know, maybe it was 4 years, 3 years. I don't remember what it was. But anyway, I was asking her, hey, you got any other interesting cases? Next thing she knows, she's telling me about Sam Smithers. And I went, I don't believe this. I just don't believe this. You know, a church deacon who's a serial killer? We didn't have that back in Brooklyn, Dan. It was just really weird. And I said, I really got to get into it. And as I did, what I really got into, and this was the first, this is the first time I was doing a book about a serial killer. I got very lucky, just lucky. The serial killer, Sam Smithers, that was his name, the bad guy, serial killer, his wife was willing to talk to me extensively. Oh, boy. And that really, you know, it really gave me an understanding about how these people, their psyches are formed. This is not something that just happens. You know what I mean? It's not out of the blue. And quite frankly, I don't believe it's just a question of DNA. I think it's a combination of things, but especially background.
Sure. Now, with that incredible access, but you take us early in the book to November 2nd, 1993, and then they found a woman with ligature marks around her neck, beaten about the head.
Mm-hmm.
They concluded probably a strong man strangled her with a belt, but they put the prints through the system, no match. Later on the news, Susan Cowell had called, her niece, Rosalind Cruz. So you talk about this Larry Lingo. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about Rosalind Cruz what they found out quickly about her background.
Yeah, well, the bottom line is this. I forgot. You were cluing me in, but I forgot that what happened was 4 years after doing those interviews in Gibsonton, I realized that on the day that I finished the interview with the family of Grady Stiles Jr., who was Lobster Boy in Gibsonton, I was driving back on the main drag on which the body was found shortly after that starts the story, and eventually it's identified as Rosalind Cruz, who was someone who was working as a prostitute. And I actually drove by the body without realizing it was there. I mean, it was night, but I was able to pinpoint it on the basis of the time frame that the police established and what I knew, you know, when I had interviewed these individuals in Gibsonton. And so I knew the area, you know, I knew the area real well. And also I knew the police real well. That those things all helped.
It's interesting too, you talk about initially with the investigation and a detective Lingo, very colorful Larry Lingo, 52 years old. You talk about that initially that there was different suspects with the Cruz case, the Pat and Linda Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
So as many cases do, as we find out in these books, that's what happens. Then the police have to follow those logical lines, those logical leads. So how do they proceed with this case?
Well, in this particular case, that Lingo was with the same police department that subsequently investigated the death of these two of the two absolute known victims, 110% of Sam Smithers. And so he was able to eventually put it together, even though the DNA wasn't 100%. They had, you know, they had mitochondrial DNA, but it was really enough to prove there was a match. So they already got him at three, and then there was one in the Florida Panhandle, as I recall, that also they suspected he had committed when he lived up there. You know, I don't think we'll ever know exactly how many people this particular, this is one of those cases. I don't think we'll ever know exactly how many people this individual murdered. You know what I mean? It's, but it's all very, very sad. And that's what gets to me more than anything, Dan, that the individuals that were murdered, you know, and not, you know, but it just bothers me. And then the wife and son, oh my God, I've never ever had a situation where I talked to a, you know, there was a son of a serial killer. Excuse me? You know, that doesn't usually happen in real life. Maybe on Investigation Discovery, you know, but, you know, not for me.
Let's, before we go into his life, and then, and of course, the incredible access and information you gained from talking to his wife, Sharon, and the son, let's talk about how he got to be a deacon of a church and his background before that, living with his father, Alvin, and his mother, Linny. What was the, again, we don't get to see this in the book till much later when his brother testifies later.
Yes.
We won't want to jump ahead. Tell us about his early life in this household.
Well, he grew up in Chattanooga, suburb of Chattanooga, Tennessee, Sam Smithers. And he was a, he grew up in a very, in a church-going family. And the thing is, we can bottom line it, which is Sharon, his wife, told me that he was physically, he and his siblings were physically abused by his mother. So let's start with that. You know what I mean? We're not talking about he's going around rats and things like that, you know, like, you know, you see with certain profiles of serial killers. No, what's happening here is he's getting abused physically by the mother. It's also possible there may have been some sort of, you know, other abuse. But in any case, I mean, there's no evidence of that, but it's anything's possible. But the bottom line here is this. He went to church on a regular basis, and he was very active in the church. That's where he met his eventual wife. But he also had so many problems from what was going on in his life, that he eventually became, I don't know, I guess you'd call it a firebug, where he'd set fires that would, he would set the fire and then be the guy that put it out, and therefore he was a big hero. That happened a number of times. And that, and while there was, what do you call it, some, therapy involved after that occurred, it never left.
Yeah, it's very interesting. We just did a program with Frank Girardo, and his book Burned, and it was almost the same thing. A volunteer fireman person involved as a firefighter, starting the fires, then getting that congratulations for being the genius that put out the fire. In this case, you say they, he finally gets caught by this Inspector Hayes, after a woman's car is on fire. He bangs on the door, oh my God, your car is on fire. So finally, even though you say he's probably got aided by the community in terms of leniency, finally he's arrested for that, and of course not given much for this arson, not taken too seriously.
Bottom line is he basically set fires at his church. People could have really, really been hurt. And it was just luck that it didn't work out that way. You know what I mean? It was just luck that they were able to put all that out and nobody was hurt.
There was also signs, again, you referenced the Me Too movement, and so maybe we should talk about that. There was some events that would be disturbing today, but at that time were treated a little bit differently. What are the kinds of things that some of the people that volunteered for community service at this First Baptist Church reported to the authorities?
Yes, yes. What happened was
custodian.
Yes, sir. Custodian at the First Baptist Church. And what happened was that included working with women who were serving community service. And I mean, it's like the last thing in the world you'd be thinking of, I mean, prior to the Me Too movement, certainly. And what happens is women come forward and they say, okay, he came on to me. A couple of times they say he put hands on them physically, in a sexual way. And the church then has to, make a decision about what it's going to do about this. By the way, again, the guy is a deacon. We're not talking about a reverend or anything,
Right.
But it's funny, Dan, whenever I do one of your, I'm lucky enough to be interviewed by you. I got to go back and read the whole book, because if I don't do that,
I don't remember what the hell I did.
Yeah.
And so I was, and I when I look at this thing, what's that word? I don't know if the word is enabling. Yesterday I'm reading about Les Moonves, okay? Right? But here's a guy. Now, I'm not saying it's the same situation, obviously, but here's a guy who's coming on to women in exactly the way that some of these individuals have been who've been indicted to be a serial killer. Now, I'm not saying that Harvey Weinstein is a serial killer or something. That's not the point. The point is we've let this stuff slide for so long because women were second-class citizens, at least, in the United States. I always tend to believe that Canada's, further along than us. Yeah.
Well, the citizens aren't. So the thing is that you still have the same sort of mentality everywhere. I mean, it's a universal mentality that now is coming to light. It's been a radical shift with Weinstein, Cosby,
yeah.
And so, you have the situation now, but. Back in this case, in this story, what it really indicates is that people were willing to give him the benefit of the doubt because he was a deacon, because he was a family man, and that helped him, like you say, enabled him to be able to continue with.
Yes.
If he started with arson and he had the sexual harassment, then that emboldened him to believe he could get away with a lot of other crimes, and then that's why he was, even though it seems like he's a little bit organized, he was sloppy when it counted. So luckily.
But as you're saying all this, what gets to me is that no names, no nothing. But it seems to me that since we have a pattern. And again, this is, you know, it's not true crime per se, but it looks to me, well, maybe it is, that you've got a pattern of people enabling a guy. What happens at the end of the day? Two individuals are murdered. And, of
sure.
course, you know, when those individuals happen to be prostitutes, their lives are not considered to be the same by a lot of people, okay? But that's not the point. Lives are lives, you know? And
well,
and,
the first person that disregarded them is Sam Smithers. So the thing is, and then from there we don't care as much, but the first person was able to do that was this. You know, what's interesting in your book is that you go back and you talk to his wife, but you weave it into the story. This guy is, and I mean, lots of other women that have been married to serial killers, associated with serial killers, said he was really great in a relationship. Again, this one is even more detailed in that he wasn't violent. When he got angry, he went for a walk. He went outside. He never spoke in crude language. His sex was normal, even though he was frequenting prostitutes. He always made it home for supper, and he was a good father. And
you know,
no exaggeration, that's...
As you're saying all this, you're putting all this together from what I wrote, and I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, gee, why isn't the Royal Canadian Mounted Police hire Dan as a consultant?
They'd be in trouble.
You put it all together. Seriously, it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, I'm not as versed. You do a lot of interviews. You talk to a lot of writers, certainly a lot more than me. So I'm not as versed as you are on, you know, some of this stuff. I have to say that this guy, and the son. Yeah, I'm a baseball fan. And so when I found out the son was I just looked this up. I wrote a note. I said, tell Dan this. I wrote a note. You ready for this?
Sure.
His son was drafted by the Boston Red Sox.
Right.
In 1998. Okay? And I'm looking through the list of names, you know, and he didn't go with him because he wanted to go to college and all that stuff. But I'm looking through the other names. Who else is drafted that year? Mark Teixeira, who wound up as the New York Yankees first baseman. And I'm laughing, and I'm going, okay, Fred, do we have any other instances in American criminal history where the son of a serial killer is drafted by a baseball team, let alone the Boston Red Sox, and we have to let our good friend Hank Garfield know about that.
You know
what I mean? But you know, it's. But I guess what got me is when I talked to Sharon, she humanized everything for me. That's why I was so lucky. This is a book about a guy who was a serial killer, but he is a human being, not was, is a human being. Sitting on death row, but he's still a human being.
We got to tell people, too, that Sharon has an even more unusual and extraordinary role in this story, in this case, because later when he is questioned, even in the arson, he demands that she is in the room. And when they did get the arson, which is foreboding of what happens later, his denials turn into a full-blown confession with Sharon at his side. Isn't that true?
Isn't that fascinating? I've never seen that, by the way.
No.
You know, the cops were very specific with me because, again, these are the Hillsborough County detectives who work Lobster Boy. For my money, it's one of the best police departments, maybe the best that I've ever worked with, detective divisions in the country.
Right.
So they gave me full access to everything. It was, you know, unbelievable. And they explained to me that basically what was happening here was that Sharon, oh, rather Sam, when they got Sam into custody, he wanted Sharon there. And as it turns out, when he was charged with arson, you know, 15, 20 years earlier, whatever it was, same thing happened. He wanted Sharon there. And the other thing that was really cool about this case was that it was, and I'll just say it, it was a female detective. That's not common. Okay, let me just say this. Okay, I realize that we, you know, we all watch TV and all this stuff, but I got to tell you guys that it isn't very common to have a lead investigator in a case as a woman, in my experience. Okay, it's changing, of course. But in this case, it was a woman named Dorothy Flair who was so friggin' good. And the other detective on the case was Mike Ouellette, who had solved Lobster Boy.
Yeah.
And I'm laughing. You know, it's like, oh, small world. You know, yeah. I you know, it isn't very often you get to do more than one book in nonfiction where you're writing about the same cop, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in the same, the thing is the same county too, and we should get to this story that really broke this whole thing, that really was, again, is very, very movie-esque. And we talked about him being a caretaker at this, at his church, his East Ridge Baptist Church. But the thing is, it doesn't pay all of the bills, so he needs another type of job. And through his history, he's been hustling, and, you know, just the nature of the economy. He had jobs, and they lost jobs, and the economy changed. But he was working for a woman named Beth Modine who had a property, and he was a caretaker. So tell us about this story where he's a caretaker for her, and he has all these duties. He has a garage or some tools.
You want me to get
let's
to
just
number
pick
one
it,
on,
let's
this,
just,
on this? Do you want
pardon
me,
me
to get to number one on this question, Dan?
Just get to – just for us, because we're skipping over some of it, but get to what she sees before what later is realized, because she sees something and then realizes something, and he reacts, she reacts.
Here's what happens. As we have discussed, prior to any known homicides, is already sort of a suspect kind of individual because of the way he's been acting toward women. But only certain people know about it. All right. Well, to make ends meet, he's got a job as a private caretaker for a property out in the country. And I went out there to look at it while I was writing the book, because, you know, you got it when all the readers that are listening tonight and listeners, you guys expect me to do this stuff. Of course I'm going to do it. You know? And so I go out and I take a look and this, that, and the other thing, and then I put it together with you know, what's, you know, what actually happens. Oh, and I almost forgot it. Dan, there used to be a TV series called Columbo. It's Columbo, you know, you'd always say, I forgot one thing. Oh, boy. The cops said in their report, see, I got all the documentation. You know, this was a period of time where, you can still do it in Florida. It's one of the few places. They'll give you everything. And they gave me the documentation about this place called Hillsborough Avenue. What do I know? You know, I'm from Brooklyn. So when I was down there investigating, you know, it said that, well, there's all these prostitutes, and I rode down that avenue, and I went, oh, my God, I've never seen, even in New York. You know, it reminded me of what 42nd Street used to look like, you know.
Okay.
And it was quite interesting because it gave me a feeling for what I was writing about, which, of course, is the most important thing, you know, and for the individuals I was writing about. Did I get too far off track?
So we were talking about Beth Modine discovering Smithers at her home, which was not unusual, but she does see some things that are very unusual, especially in retrospect.
Right. Let me talk about that. What happens is Sam, let's just talk about it from Beth's point of view. That's better.
Yeah.
Beth shows up because it's her property. You know, and she's, you know, Sam happens to be there. He's not there all the time, but he's there. She goes into like this sort of like a barn kind of a structure, and she sees some blood on the walls, and then they're on the floor, and she figures that it's maybe an animal or something, but she doesn't like, she's getting bad vibes. Oh, and there's one more thing, which is there's a trail. Oh, man, you can't write this stuff. You can't make this stuff up, rather. There's a trail of, like, potato chips or Doritos or something leading outside with blood. Well, if she realized, you know, she looks at him, and she goes at Sam Smithers, and she says, I better get the heck out of here, and she does. She leaves. She goes down to the highway, and then she from there she calls the police, and eventually respond, and they go back to the place, and they find some interesting things.
There is a pond behind the home, behind this home, and they, as you say, it looks like drag marks, like a drag path, they call it, to this pond.
Yes, sir.
When McLaurie comes and they look at this pond, what do they find?
Well, then, when the police respond to Modine's, you know, request, trail. By the way, that's the first time I've ever heard that term. I don't know about you, but I'd never heard drag trail. Sounds like something from an old Western, you know, with Jimmy Stewart. But anyway, you've watched Jimmy Stewart in the Westerns?
Sure.
Okay. Anyway, try Winchester 73. But anyway, here's what happens. The cop follows the drag trail over, you know, with the chips. Boy, man, oh, man. To this pond. It's a small pond, guys. You know, it's like, you know, it's a small pond. What's in it? They find a body. They find a body is newly dead. And then they continue to look in the pond, and they bring in the dive team, which I got a kick out of. That gave me a couple of lines in the book then, right? And so they bring in the dive team, and they find a body at the other end. And now they got to take a look at these two bodies and see what the heck is going on.
Now they look at, they find two bodies, obviously. One's more decomposed. Of course, they go through prints for match. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. Keep going. They go for prints. Keep going.
So they eventually get an identification of what they're calling Jane Doe number two, the first person in the water.
Yes. And what happens is, it's interesting. See, I find that stuff, this is actually the case where I started understanding, oh boy, I'm going to sound like I'm a scientist. I don't mean to, but body, how long it takes, the conditions, and so forth and so on. Because these people in Hillsborough County all talked to me about this. And it was fascinating, you know, some of this is going to be obvious to most people, I suppose, but, you know, I never think about it, Dan. I mean, I don't know if anybody does, but if you're in a warm, humid climate, a body's going to decompose faster than in a cooler climate, number one. Number two, if the body is in water, warm water,
sure.
Well, thank God in this particular case, it was a pond. If he dumped the body in, you know, the ocean or something, the sharks would have gotten it. You know, this was different. They were able to use forensics. And this was late 90s.
Yeah.
You know, it's... You know, go ahead.
Sorry.
No, I'm just... you know, it's funny, Dan. You know, when we talk... By the way, I said to myself, I have to tell this to Dan. You know, it's a lot cheaper to talk to you than to my therapist. Did I ever tell you that? Go ahead. Go ahead.
But still, not great results, maybe. Let's talk about Christy Cowan, because this case demonstrates everything, and also really demonstrates to the reader and our audience tonight the incredible access you have to be able to get. This is beyond behind the scenes. This is when we talked about Beth Modine and at this property and at the pond, Christy Cowan is still alive in this pond with an axe wound chopping the head. He had tried to strangle her and she was still making noise. He says later, as we find out from you, Fred, from your incredible research, that she's still moaning in the back. So he goes and he hits her with pieces of wood. Finally, she's still moaning. He goes out and gets a hoe, wades in the water, and chops her till she's dead. This is the kind of information that the police eventually find out that this is Christy Cowan.
Yes.
They find out the other identification of the other woman, and now they have Sam Smithers arrested, and how they proceed.
Yeah, and as you're laying it out, Dan, it's very interesting because in a way you're almost laying it out like a prosecutor would. I'm not saying you're the prosecutor. I'm just saying what I find interesting about this is this is somebody. I'm sitting here and I'm shaking my head. You see, I felt the same way, and we'll talk about it eventually. I feel the same way about this guy and still do as the judge that sentenced him to death, which is there was a lot of stuff going on here. And look, it's no surprise to your listeners that, you know, I'm not a death penalty guy for a lot of different reasons, okay?
Right.
You know what? I prefer studying these guys under microscopes so we could prevent future crimes. But in any case, you know, what happens here, you know, when we talk about, oh, boy. See, these prostitutes, you know, I was trying to decide when I should tell you this. Christy Cowan and Denise Roach, a.k.a. New York, she came originally from Jamaica, went to New York, etc. Cowan was from Connecticut. After I published the book originally, I was contacted by, oh my God, that this shocked me, Dan. You know, I was actually talking to somebody who had walked away, you know, had found her way in life. I don't have any words, you know, because she could have been a victim. But, she turned it around, you know. And what that gave me an appreciation of is how easy it is for people to fall from, you know, wherever they are to someplace else. Money, not getting a job, illness, you name it. And then having to be so desperate. And I keep, and I've seen this in a number of instances.
Yeah, you include in the book that you talk about Hillsborough County and Hillsborough Avenue, and this is
yeah.
the strip these women work on. And
yeah.
And they had friends, and so they were looking out after each other. And so when they weren't around for a while, they knew that something was up. But also they had rudimentary precautionary techniques, like they wouldn't go to a John's house, per se, because it would be less control. But
great
in this
point.
Case, in this case, it was unless there was plenty of crack, unless there was plenty of money.
Yes.
And that's,
and
that's
what,
how this
what,
happened.
Yes, he was able to use drugs to lure the women to go with him where he wanted to go to, so he could, I mean, you know, it's, you know, not you know, we're dealing with somebody, when you start dealing with somebody like a Sam Smithers, all logic goes out the window. You're dealing with a killer, and is, you know, you can you can say it, you know, this happened, that happened in his life, blah blah blah, but you still don't know what's going on. The fact is, he's a killer, you know. This
yeah.
is somebody that, you know, needs to be put away.
You introduce a character that's again
yes.
very colorful. This Pops Baker, a very he's, and so he's a corporal, and so he's in control of people like Dorothy Flair. And so when they finally put this together with Sam Smithers, they have to question him. Of course, they have the approach. Again, we talked about Sharon's role, his wife's role in this.
Yeah, yeah.
What was that question like again? What did they get from that? And we alluded to it already, but tell us what happens
yeah,
in
well,
this question.
Well, I like to. I'm sitting here. I got a big smile on my face because when you mentioned Pops Baker, what happened was when I first started working in Hillsborough County, this was the third book I wrote about Hillsborough County. There was another one. But what I'm getting at is that Pops Baker was the head of everything. So I knew this is the dude. You know, he knew what he was doing, and he assigned so-and-so to do this, and he assigned so-and-so to do that, and so forth, and so on. So that's number one. I knew that, you know, they knew what they were doing here. Now, wait a minute, what was your other question? I'm sorry.
Well, we talked about, you know, Pop spoke with Sharon. He wanted, and she was there right with him, right there at the police station.
Okay,
but she wasn't in
now.
An interrogation room. But
yeah,
Dorothy Flair, as you write, questioned Sam.
Yeah, here's what happens. We go back to what happened back in Chattanooga, Tennessee, when Sam, sometime in the early 80s, had tried to burn down his church and that car and so forth. And he wouldn't talk to the cops unless they brought Sharon in. Well, you know, fade out, fade in. He says the same thing here. So what happens is, I've never seen this. Flair brings in, you know, there's Flair and Willette, the two main cops. They're going to split up. One's going to interview Smith, Sam, and the other's going to interview Sharon. And what happens is, they bring them both in. And they sit them down, and they start talking to them. And what happens is, eventually, they get Sam to talk with Sharon in the room, and then Sam starts confessing.
Of course, like any psychopathic serial killer, he'd rather try to avoid total responsibility. And so in fact there's no denials, but there is a sanitization of why this happened as well, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. You see, the thing is, when you see sanitization, boy, that's a hell of a good word. You're dealing with a situation where this guy was a church deacon. He was a pillar of his community. People don't want somebody like that, you know, who they supported, to be reported as a serial killer, for God's sake. You know? And again, what's so interesting to me is that what's happening at the point, and you mentioned it earlier, now that he's brought in and they're questioning Smithers, Larry Lingo, the investigator on the earlier homicide with Cruz, he's sitting there. You know, and they, and you know, they wind up using forensics, you know, to get Smithers' DNA, and they get what essentially is a mitochondrial DNA match, which simply means that they don't have them 110%, but they've got them over 50%, you know, without going into I'll let your next forensic scientist go into details on this. But the point is, they tied him into that. So now you got three. Then you got a suspected one. In other words, we've got three people dead that we can tie into Sam Smithers. Three. Then we've got a fourth, which I don't deal with too much in the book because we don't have too much information in the Florida Panhandle. But even at three, to say, isn't it? Steven. Dan, as I get older and I get more experience, these are people's mothers, sisters, brothers. You know what I mean? We have to have a certain amount of compassion about what we're doing, and I think we do have that. You know, I think we do have that. But, the good news here is that the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Department, they're fantastic. I don't know what else to say. And, they're not paying me a penny, buddy, you know? Yeah. And by the way, they live right – not live. They're only down the block from this place that makes great Cuban cigars. So they could buy me off in a heartbeat. But, hey.
There you go.
Just
I'll
a joke. Just –
What's interesting is in the book you detail this dogged effort by police, this Dorothy Flair. She even wrote the president of Trojan Condom Company. It wasn't the president, but somebody important at Trojan Condom Company to get a match to put Sam at the murder scene for that number three. So this is this is over and beyond police work. Yeah.
You know what? Oh, man. You know what? You're giving me perspective, seriously, because you talk to people, you know, more than I do, you know, all over the place. And, yes, here's what happens. Dorothy Flair, who is the investigator in the case, becomes aware that there is a rapper from a condom at the crime scene where he was, you know, at this place out in the country that he was, where he killed these two women, but he also made love to them there. So they found this rapper, and it turns out, oh man, it was a good, what a piece of detective work. Oh man. They went back and they talked to one of the victims. I think it was Denise's. I think it was Denise, but it's not even relevant. It's like it's one of the two victims' friends who said she gave the victim $10
Timothy Flair, the detective on the case, finds this wrapper at the scene of the crime, checks it with the company, and is able to trace it back and eventually find out that it was the same condom given to the victim by her friend. And that is a piece of exculpatory, incriminating evidence against Sam Smithers that puts him essentially into the death chamber, though he's, of course, still alive.
You talk about that as well, that most times that a defendant will not take the stand, even in a death penalty case. Of course, in this case, after denying that Sharon, the confession he gave with Sharon, he tried to say it was coerced. So, of course, we go
right
through the obligatory attempts to nullify what has already been done, what has already been said, and then they try to do a diminished capacity defense. Of course, everything that they can. Death penalty opponents, a couple people are recused. So he has different legal aid attorneys. But really, he gets up on the stand, and what kind of story does he weave when he has the opportunity? What does he say? Sharon has been with him till another person gets in her life, but she had been loyal to him,
well,
regardless of what he thought was a coerced confession. He gets on that stand. What's his version?
Well,
what's
his
he has
version
to say?
is too weird. He claims he's the victim of a conspiracy. Some mysterious individuals are trying to convict him. That's it.
He controlled him. He was threatened. He had to do the duty. But he also got paid.
Right.
It was really interesting. He says, the guy forced me, threatened me to kill these, been dispose of the people he killed, but then he gave me $400 for my effort. So.
Yeah, well, no evidence of that. He was full of crap.
No, of course.
It's, but it was good. You know, it was good. Especially if you say, oh, hey, I'm going to get a political comment in here. It's good, especially if you say you're going to pay with cash.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but I
no
didn't
problem.
Get, I didn't get. I'm okay on that one, right, Dan?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The.
No, it's important, Dan. You know, and by the way, Dan, I have to tell you something. Since you are, thank God, a Canadian citizen, the New York Mets lost 25-1 or something last night to the Washington Nationals, who used to be the Expos. Okay?
Okay.
Dan, 25 runs? Excuse me? Let's move on. I know
that's a route.
I'm off track.
When we talk about this death penalty, we always have opponents, obviously, and people trying to save this guy's life regardless of what. But there are mitigating circumstances and other things called aggravators and mitigators. There wasn't any mitigators in this, was there? There was attempts, but...
If you're, you know what? You know what? You're forcing me to be objective, which is important as a journalist. And at the same time, it reminds me of the decision that Bill Fuente, the judge in the case who I interviewed, which is very rare,
right,
told me. And that is that according to the law, the guy was guilty. There's nothing else to say, okay? I'm not for the death penalty, as I've said, but I will tell you that here in Florida, where I do live, one of the things they do is if someone's in that situation, and I'm not kidding on this one. They'll give them over $1 million to defend themselves. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
this was not something where the mitigating circumstances, how many people that are listening to our show tonight, to your show tonight, not our show, your show tonight, across the world, how many of you have faced abuse as a child, but you grew beyond it? That's not an excuse.
No.
That is not an excuse to commit murder. Sorry, guys. It's not an excuse.
At the same time, there is an examination in here, and at least the defense lawyers tried to paint a portrait that the mother, Linny, and the father,
yeah.
The father was an alcoholic, and then the
yeah.
mother beat the kids, but it was mixed in with religiosity, so that when he became a deacon, again, there's,
yes.
again, I don't agree with any kind of blame. I agree with you that, again, you have to take responsibility, and that's it. I don't want to hear too much about how this was created. But the thing
yeah.
is that this humiliation, again, whether, mm-hmm. Lots of people have been humiliated. I've had humiliation. You've been humiliated, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
At least what we thought was humiliation. But it seems that this is the reoccurring theme with these guys, that they're such a
Ooh.
Fragile ego that can't get over that mother's domineering control. As you write in a book, she was still controlling in his marriage. When they bought a bigger, beautiful home, she was still. It's very weird. She would stay in the house and say, "Well, I don't know if I could feel comfortable. You've overpaid for this house, obviously. I don't know. The house might be taken away. I can't really feel comfortable." And he still conceded to his mother, even through his marriage.
You see what you're saying. Yes, this guy's making excuses.
Sure.
Okay. And, when you look at it, you say to yourself, wait a sec. How many people listening to us tonight have been through these situations? You guys are fine individuals. Otherwise, I'd be tracking you down. So the thing is, we got to, there's other aspects. And again, we could talk about this forever, about there's got to be some other aspects. It's not just a question of nature and nurture. There's got to be some other aspects involved here. And I've always suspected that when it comes to serial killers, we're talking about something genetic. And eventually, whenever, the Starship Enterprise gets around to it, they'll figure out what happened.
Well, I think the thing is our treatment of, like we said, the people don't really care. The police, again, I hate to beat up on, but police historically will tell people or have told people numerous times, listen, they're probably just gone away. You've got nothing to worry about. And they're probably well-intended, but it's not good advice. And it ends up, at least most people's experience is that they don't seem to be as concerned. And I can seem to understand because they don't have any leads. They're leading a dangerous lifestyle. And again, there's no leads. So there can be less effort or more effort has to be put into something that people will agree that there's less effort in finding these people, in caring about people that seemingly, according to the police that work with these people all the time, they're not helping themselves. They're hurting. They're putting themselves in danger. But also that the idea that we know that over and over again, these serial killers target these people. And yet as a society, once a person falls through that cracks of addiction, then is selling themselves on the street, then the serial killer takes out all his frustrations in his life. But the thing is that these prostitutes and prostitution, you open up a phone book, even in innocent, fantastic Canada, It's just like a pizza. That is accepted. So the street prostitute that's 15 years old and 16 years old, again, is tolerated. Somehow. It's illegal. It's immoral. It's important. It could be our daughters. It could be anyone involved with us. But it's not a priority. And the serial killer over and over and over again goes there to vent. And then in the courts, of course, we can put them to death. But these problems still exist, and we can raise awareness, but I don't know how much more aware of this we can get. Your book, everyone's book, tells about this, so
you know,
here we are again.
No, you know what I love about what you're saying? You're really getting into morals and ethics, and I totally agree with you, obviously. I mean, we are, you want to know something? I'll just say it. I don't know how it is in other places. You know, I try to keep up with what's going on. What I find is hard is that, yeah, we're talking about murder. We're talking about serial killers. We're the good guys. In other words, there was a period of time when there were role models to be heroes, good guys, and that doesn't exist anymore. You know, I don't know. All I can say is, you know, when I was reading again what I wrote about Sam Smithers, and I was reading it today, and it's been a long time, you know, since I read it, Dan. I was reading this and I was going, why the hell didn't somebody stop this guy earlier? You know, that's what got me.
Yeah. Well, I think the only thing you can do, and I was speaking to somebody just recently talking about sex trafficking, and I said the courts have a responsibility in recognizing the kinds of personalities by their proven behavior that exhibits and distance themselves or separates from less serious, again, I hate to use that, less serious criminals. There are some criminals that are obvious to everyone, it seems, except that conviction record, that this person is a dangerous person, and this is the kind of person we need to recognize as having this kind of behavior, because we see stalking, and we see break and enter, and we see some of these things turn to murder. So, of course, you can't prosecute people for a break and enter where no one was hurt, but when there is a recognized violent act, I think if you look at all these true crime cases, if that were the case,
yes,
then it would have been intervention before more bodies, let's put it that way.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I keep seeing this in various cases I've written about, and I go, why didn't somebody intervene over here? Why didn't somebody intervene over there? You know, and I'm especially talking about serial killers, you know, and so, you know, look, it is what it is. But when I wrote Deacon of Death, I guess, the thing that got me the most was that, and I mentioned it earlier, enabling this guy from a very young age. That's what's interesting. You know, when you actually get access to background information on a serial killer, and you can sort of report, not sort of, but you report to the reader about what the person's about, and that's what I did here.
What kind of information, you know, because people really don't see the kind of information that you've gathered because it's just interwoven into the narrative. What exactly did you get from Sharon? I mean, again, it's very unique for you to talk to a wife of a serial killer, and especially this kind of wife that was supportive yet couldn't believe, especially for a long time, that her husband could ever do any of this. So she was a very naive woman from a particular sort of background as well. What kind of stuff, tell us more, even just tell us more about the actual meeting with her and what she actually gave you.
There was no physical meeting. What happened was I was able to track her down through records. I called her. I told her what I was doing. And we just started talking for quite some time, which is the way any journalist would do it. I'm thinking of Ronan Farrow, but my father is not Woody Allen, or, you know. But anyway, but I just called her, and we started chatting, and we formed a relationship. And I just told her, I was just trying to, you know, I told her what I learned from Carl Bernstein. I gave a lecture once that I was at, and Bernstein said that the idea of journalism is the best obtainable version of the truth. That's what I told her I was trying to find, the best obtainable version of the truth. So she helped me in telling me what her life was like with her husband and so forth. And it was a very unusual situation. Certainly, it was the first time I'd ever had that kind of a situation. And she was forthcoming, very forthcoming, and, you know, impressed me as just a really nice human being.
It's interesting, you write that they met when she was 12 and he was 14 in, I guess, school or religious settings.
Yeah.
And they never were apart until he was questioned, and one of the detectives said, listen, we think that you should call somebody, not stay with him tonight. Then so she was convinced, and then he kept saying after for an incredible amount of time, you left me. He was incredulous that she had actually left him because they hadn't been apart for years and years and years.
Great point. Great point. What happened was they met at such a young age. They were together sort of like the, I'll think of the country western singer in a second, but it was, they were together every day of their lives from the age of about 20 or so, okay? When they got married, I think she was 17, he was 20, and that was it, you know? And they were always together. They had this relationship where every day they were together. They were never apart. That is, neither one of them ever traveled, per se. She also was a very obviously trusting individual and trusted sure. that he wasn't doing anything unusual. Event, you know, late at night, and of course that wasn't the case. He was leaving late at night and going out, making it with hookers, and did it in the early morning hours and so forth and so on.
What's interesting, too, is that he had this secret life, and she had no idea of this. He was successful in keeping that.
Ooh.
But he did have quite a bit of a different character, even scared off. It's noted that he even scared off a couple people with some of his demands. So he couldn't really reach out to regular women for an affair. He had to go to these streets, to these people that were desperate for some of the things that he wanted to do sexually. Yeah, correct?
You know, that is a really excellent observation. That's absolutely true. He wanted things sexually that, and, you know, we don't have, you know, a lot of details, but he certainly was into a certain amount of physical stuff. And the guy had a screw loose. And now we could try to analyze it from now until doomsday regarding the mother, but it's a waste of time. It's really a waste of time, because what it all comes down to is he was an abusive individual.
who would eventually commit at least two murders that we know of, possibly three.
There was an inmate that was involved, and, and like many of these cases, there's always somebody, it seems, ready to come forward. I thought that, maybe it's going to be talk of other murders, but it wasn't. But what was that talk that sort of seemed to conflict with what Sharon thought and some other people thought about the former deacon?
Just that he'd done it. He said that he'd done it.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, and he went into some detail, whatever it might be, but he was just saying that he'd done it. And that's where it is, you know, where he was deviating from, you know, his story to the police later, where he said it was some strange individual that did it.
Yeah.
Look, we're dealing with a wire here. You know,
I think it's interesting too when the psychopathic nature of these guys is evident when they make that decision to take the stand. Somebody says, well, it's a last-ditch effort and they might as well try to defend themselves. But they really, it is an ultimate, I think, in the narcissism that the psychopath has, that he thinks, well, I think I might be able to do this. I'll get that examination, I'll get that story out there, and then I'll go toe-to-toe with these people.
Oh, I agree with that totally. Absolutely. There's the narcissism you're talking about is classic. Absolutely classic.
You talk about Sharon as well, that the spell that he weaved on her, she even visited him in prison every day for many years. But there was a person named Rex.
Boyfriend.
I don't know if you talked to her on the phone about this, but she was able to break away from this life of being dependent upon Sam Smithers, wasn't she?
Yeah, she found a boyfriend, and eventually, after he was in prison for a while, and she wound up divorcing him and marrying this other fellow.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. You know, she was able to find a way to move on, but obviously it must have been terribly difficult.
Yeah. And she knew at some point, too, that she needed to shield her son from this as well, when she did realize, well, despite thinking she knew him, she needed to protect her son.
Yeah, but the problem was her son was approaching adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of the things I was able to research was that their son, and I'm not going to give his name, I'd rather he keep his anonymity.
Right.
He is now a physical therapist in Boston. So while he never played for the Sox, he's up there doing physical therapy, which is cool.
He was convicted for Denise Roach, and he was Christy Cowan and Cruz.
Not Cruz.
So only he was convicted for Cowan and Roach.
Yes.
Were not able to have enough evidence to get any more convictions? I know that you write in the book that there was other police from other jurisdictions looking into that. Was there any leads from that? Was there any results from that at all?
No, there weren't. If they'd got him, they would have done it. But no, they didn't get it. They couldn't nail him on anything else. The Cruz situation was such that, as I mentioned, it was not 100% DNA matchable, but it looked like they did it with mitochondrial DNA, which is about a 50% match, which essentially says
It's from someone in a particular family. Duh. So, yeah, but it's not enough for a conviction.
Right.
Well, for that matter, a prosecution.
Now, what was the you alluded that the conviction was the death penalty, and just tell us about the state itself, why he doesn't have a quick order to be put to death, or didn't have a quick order.
Well, there is no such thing as a quick order in Florida. Basically, the way it works in Florida is at the time this occurred, the jury votes on whether or not to convict the individual, and then the jury votes whether the individual gets death. However,
right.
The law has changed here since this, so that all the individuals who were condemned to death on the basis of just, the jury saying it, it doesn't work. They're going back to having a jury look at it. The point is, right now, Sam Smithers, yeah, he's on death row, but he's not going to be executed for a while. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to happen for a while. And, there's a lot of guys on death row that are ahead of him.
Have you heard of any movement or anything, any events, anything, any stories emanating from the cell of Sam Smithers? Has he made any statements, anything publicly that he's done?
No.
Any word from him?
Nothing. Nothing. Quiet. Very quiet.
Yeah. Interesting.
Very, very quiet.
And you said that this was the Hillsborough County has been a source of stories for you three
yes.
times now for three books. Very interesting.
Yes. Yeah, they lost a boy, and then Deacon of Death, and then this book, which is Deacon of Death. And I've also written I wrote a book called, about a murder case up in Tallahassee, Florida, which is Trails of Death. But this is different because this particular police department is extremely open. Now, the state itself is, because we have an open records law, but these individuals I find to be the best out in Hillsborough County.
Yeah, that's it. All the cumulative things that have happened in this case, the incredible access you had, and like you say, the open records policy of Florida has created this book. It's just incredible graphic detail, and then... we get the incredible background of Sam growing up and his odd family, including his mother, Linny, and just the sad and disheartening life of these prostitutes on the strip here. You even include, the sexual activities that these people offer, the meager prices, and just... The heartbreaking thing of the protection that Christy Cowan had to say that she was not going to go to these John's apartments, and then quickly, soon as he offered a little bit of money, and then their fate was sealed. So I want to congratulate you on. I know it's a book that's back in the past, but again, crime classic, Deacon of Death. I want to thank you, Fred, for coming on and sharing the story with us. For those that might want to talk to you, you're out there and you're out on message boards and you're out there on discussion boards.
Facebook.
But for those that just heard you for the first time, tell us about your, say, website and Facebook pages, Fred.
My Facebook page is, Fred Rosen, whatever they call it at Facebook, and I'm just putting up my site, which is fredrosen.com. So
there we go.
I look forward to talking to people, I can't thank you enough for giving me the opportunity to talk to your 1 million listeners across the world, Dan.
Well, thank you very much, Fred, and it's always nice because we always, as you know, on Facebook, there's been always talk of how people love our interviews, the banter between us, and just talking about your fantastic true crime book. So thank you very much, Fred. You have a great evening,
you.
And I know I will be talking to you again real soon.
Okay, you take care now. Adios.
Adios, Fred. Good night.
Bye.